society to thrive are characteristically hidden, suppressed, denied, and simply ignored. Erasure of the truth is a practice of genocide, refusing to admit actual genocide by downplaying actions that the state not only instigated but continues to protect is a practice of genocide. These systems are in need of profound scrutiny and destabilization, as absence of remorse or accountability breeds only further promise of harm. As the Canadian government, RCMP, and churches abdicate responsibility and place the onus on each other to apologize, Indigenous voices are demanding that all of them, as well as the predators and murderers in official positions at these schools, be held to account for their crimes against humanity.
Around the World with Reporters.
Bagram Military Air Base in northern Parwan province was known as an American town since it was considered as the biggest U.S. military base in Afghanistan. Now, no American troop is in Bagram and it has been handed over to the Afghan government.
Both the Afghan government and the Taliban have welcomed the move. However, the militant group says the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Afghanistan's Bagram air base is a hasty escape under rising Taliban attacks across the country.
Meanwhile, many Afghans say the withdrawal needs to be viewed as a chance to remove violence from the country.
Political players in Afghanistan need to view the withdrawal of foreign troops as a big opportunity to end violence here. Both government and the Taliban must now get back to negotiations to settle the problems.
Afghan officials have always blamed the Taliban for waging war under the pretext of fighting foreign invasion. And now they call on the Taliban to logically decide on the fate of their own war-torn homeland.
If the excuse was foreign troops' presence, they are leaving now. Other issues such as ignoring the Republic or the Constitution by the Taliban don't make sense anymore. Challenges such as corruption could now be discussed peacefully. So we expect the Taliban to respect the nation's demand and responsibly resume intra-Afghan talks.
Some 9,600 foreign troops should leave Afghanistan by September 11, a deadline set by U.S. President Joe Biden, who seeks to end America's longest war. It was launched in 2001 under the pretext of fighting terrorism. However, no peace has been achieved yet, and thousands of Afghans have lost their lives since then. Afghan officials say government forces are fully ready to independently defend the country amid withdrawal of foreign troops. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
In the Iranian city of Qom marks the end of a week-long occasion known as the U.S. Human Rights Week. The annual event commemorates a series of tragic incidents that killed hundreds of Iranians. The last day of the week, which falls on July the 3rd, marks the 1988 shooting down of an Iranian airliner by the U.S. Navy, which killed all of the 290 people on board. After more than three decades, Iran is still waiting for an apology from the U.S. The American Human Rights Week also commemorates the 1981 bombing of the headquarters of Iran's Islamic Republic Party, carried out by the formidable Mujahideen-e-Khalq terrorist organization, known as the MKO. 73 leading officials, including the then Justice Chief Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti, were killed in the terror attack. In 2012, the U.S. and Europe delisted the MKO as a terrorist entity, and since then, they have been holding regular meetings with the terror group, which is now based in France and Albania. The 1987 chemical bombardment of Iran's city of Sardasht is another incident that falls in the same period on the Iranian calendar. Iraq's chemical weapons were reportedly produced using materials supplied by the U.S. and other Western countries. The 1981 attempted assassination of the then-Iranian president Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei by the MKO is also among the incidents that's marked in the American Human Rights Week.
Iran says the U.S. footprints can be traced in all of the incidents that fall in this fateful week. Activists here say Washington has so far shrugged off its crimes in Iran. And that is why Iran marks the American Human Rights Week every year to present documented instances of gross violations of human rights by the U.S., at least in Iran. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Qom.
Over 1 month since a ceasefire came into force between the Israeli regime and Hamas, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip still suffer from psychological trauma and feel unsafe. While fears are rising of another round of violence, Palestinians mark 15 years of a land, air, and sea Israeli blockade that has devastated Gaza's economy and caused widespread destruction, leaving most people largely cut off from the outside world.
The Israeli blockade imposed for 15 years led Palestinians to call for simple solutions. This blockade, of course, affected all life aspects, especially the rate of poverty and unemployment. There are many graduates who are jobless now. Wars and Israeli blockade isolated Gaza from the world, and it's not surprising that many countries know nothing about Gaza.
Israeli blockade imposed on the Gaza Strip affected badly on all life aspects, leading to high rates of poverty and unemployment. Most of the working-age population in the Gaza Strip are unemployed and without any source of income due to the lack of job opportunities.
There are a lot of graduated people without a job in Gaza. The unemployment rate is high and there are no job opportunities. For 15 years, we have been living in the same situation. There has been continuous escalations and war over Gaza, and people will suffer from everything and nothing changes.
Due to the limited sources and restrictions imposed in movement and entry of goods and fuel, only a limited amount of fuel and cooking gas reach homes and the electricity plant. As a result, Gazans are suffering an electricity crisis that has devastated daily life, especially on clean water, as people in Gaza suffer from salty and polluted water that is not fit for drinking. Both the continuous violence over the Strip and the Israeli blockade affected badly on every aspect of life for Palestinians, isolating and depriving them from their rights. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
We have a duty to fight for.
Stop denying racism and start dismantling it. Those were the unequivocal comments by Michelle Bachelet, the United Nations Human Rights Chief, following a landmark report launched after the killing of George Floyd in the United States, which called on countries worldwide to do more to tackle the systemic racism against people of African descent.
I'm calling on all states to stop denying and start dismantling racism, to end impunity and build trust, to listen to the voices of people of African descent, and to confront past legacies and deliver redress.
The report found that police use of racial profiling and excessive force was systemic in much of North America, Europe, and Latin America.
We're suffering right across the world. Adam Traoré in France, George Floyd in America, Dalian Atkinson and Kevin Clark here in the United Kingdom. You know, 24 people were shot in the favelas of African descent by Brazilian police, you know, in the last 12 months. So you can see that wherever you look.
It also concluded that racism was the biggest problem in countries steeped in the history of the transatlantic slave trade, which ultimately laid the foundations for much of the wealth they enjoy today.
The report highlighted the UK as one of 60 countries that needs to do more to help bring an end to systemic racism, notably urging them to apologise to people of African descent and make amends through reparations. Yet despite the UK playing a leading role in the transatlantic slave trade, so far the British state has shown an unwillingness to do either.
Michelle Bachelet acknowledged the pivotal role that the Black Lives Matter movement played in bringing this conversation to the forefront, but accepted that now it's on states around the world to take concrete action and make amends for centuries of violence and discrimination. But for countries like the United Kingdom, just issuing an apology would be a start. Ahmed Kabbalah, London.
American and NATO forces have finally left Afghanistan's Bagram Air Base, the hub of the US military operations in the country for nearly 20 years. The pullout marks a symbolic end to what US President Joe Biden has called Washington's forever war. It comes after Biden announced earlier this year his decision to withdraw all US forces from Afghanistan by the 20th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. The pullout has been welcomed by the Afghan people.
This is good news that the Americans left Bagram. The Americans had reached an agreement with the Taliban in Doha, and these agreements must be implemented. And this is for the good of Afghanistan.
God willing, there will be peace in this country. We want peace until the end. God is merciful, and we hope that one day there will be peace in our country.
The Taliban militant group has also welcomed the withdrawal as a positive step. The group's spokesman said the full withdrawal of foreign forces will pave the way for Afghans to decide about their future themselves. In February 2020, the administration of former President Donald Trump struck a deal with the Taliban to withdraw all U.S. troops from Afghanistan by May 2021. Joe Biden rescheduled the date and set September 11th for the pullout. The U.S. and its NATO allies invaded Afghanistan in October 2001 under the pretext of the so-called War on Terror. The Taliban militant group was removed from power following the invasion. However, after nearly two decades, the U.S. invasion failed to uproot the militant group, and Washington had to finally sit at the negotiating table with the group. According to the Pentagon, the U.S. military operations in Afghanistan have cost nearly $825 billion. Also, according to U.S. media reports, more than 2,400 U.S. military personnel have been killed in Afghanistan. The U.S. war in Afghanistan has left thousands of Afghan civilians dead and caused a significant damage to the country's infrastructure. And now, with the prospect of an end to the war, which though failed to bring security to the country, calls will certainly get louder for the prosecution of American troops and officials involved in the war crimes against the Afghan people.
Yemen's Ministry of Electricity held a sit-in protest in front of the United Nations office in the capital Sana'a to call all the international community to step in and to pressure Saudi Arabia to stop detaining Yemeni oil vessels. The ministry said it is unable to generate power anymore due to the lack of fuel.
Electricity is an essential service and has nothing to do with any political conflicts. The power sector in Yemen has been heavily affected since the first moment of the war. The Saudi-led coalition has directly targeted all electric power plants, and this is a great tragedy for us. The UN has not done anything to end the suffering of Yemenis. We demand the lifting of the siege and releasing the oil ships so we can generate electricity again.
At the same place, Yemeni children organized a gallery for the drawings. The gallery was named The U.S. Kills Our Childhood and exhibited children's drawings that show the suffering of Yemeni children due to the ongoing conflict.
We participated in this protest to tell the United Nations, which classified Ansarullah in its blacklist of groups violating children's rights. We Yemenis demand our rights like any other people, on top of which is the lifting of the siege imposed on us by Saudi Arabia.
How many fathers and mothers have lost their children? This is a massive crime. This is tyranny. We are little children. We have no fault.
Saudi Arabia, backed by Washington, launched a devastating war on the impoverished country in March 2015, killing tens of thousands of civilians, including women and children, and imposing an all-out blockade.
Yemenis have held hundreds of protests here in front of the United Nations office, but the international body has not yet taken any strict measures to end the suffering of the millions of Yemenis. That is why the UN describes the situation in Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Abdul Latif Al Washali, Sana'a.
The leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki, is standing trial for allegations of culpable homicide, unlawful assembly, disruption of public peace, among other charges which the Islamic cleric has denied. Rounding up his address to the court, the leader of the defense team explained that the prosecution has not established any case against Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki. He said none of the people accused of the crimes attributed it to his client, and the court has released many of them.
If we feel that no prima facie case has been established against your client, you make a no-case submission, and that is what has happened in this case. So we are waiting for the ruling of the court.
The prosecution has presented a total of 15 witnesses, including Nigerian military officers. But Zazaki's defense team said all the witnesses that were brought before the court confirmed that they did not see Sheikh Zazaki during the attack by the army.
The prosecution called 15 witnesses. We felt that no case has been made to warrant our clients being asked to give evidence. In other words, we address the court to defend that there is nothing to defend on the part of our client.
The trial judge adjourned the case to July 28, when he is expected to deliver his ruling on the no-case submission by Zazaki's defense team. Sheikh Zazaki has been in detention since December 2015 after soldiers of the Nigerian army attacked his home and worship center, killing over 340 of his supporters. Members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria have continued with their protests, demanding the release of Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki and his wife Zinat. They have always insisted that the Islamic cleric is an innocent man who has suffered persecution by the Nigerian government. Lanjum Abdullahi, Kaduna.
Bashir Ahmed Baba is a free man now. 12 years back, he was detained at the Gujarat state of India for a crime he was unaware of.
I used to work for a German-based NGO. I and my colleague, who was non-Kashmiri, had gone to attend a training workshop on children with disabilities. It was a two-week-long program, but I was detained on the sixth day while my colleague was set free.
Baba was detained under a controversial Unlawful Activities Prevention Act, or UAPA, and was accused of making bombs in soft drink cans.
I was unaware of what I was being questioned about. I even couldn't read the charge sheet because it was in the local language. But one thing I was sure about is that one day I would walk free, because I knew I was innocent. But I never knew it would take 12 years to prove it.
Unlawful activity is defined vaguely in the law as any action, whether by an individual or an association, which disclaims, questions, disrupts, or is intended to disrupt the sovereignty and territorial integrity of India, or causes or is intended to cause disaffection against India. According to the National Crime Records Bureau data, there's a rising graph of UAPA cases in Jammu and Kashmir. The UAPA law has come under stern criticism after several activists and journalists in India were booked under it by the Hindu nationalist Narendra Modi-led Bharatiya Janata Party. Scores of Kashmiris are languishing in the jails across India. Providing legal aid and frequent meeting with the prisoners has become a challenge for their families.
In these 12 years, I have seen him once, that only after I sold my gold earring. We were drained financially after his father died of cancer, so going to him was out of our bounds.
Analysts say unlawful detention is a violation of human rights, and the covenants of civil and political rights say such people need to be compensated for unlawful detention, and for those who have falsely implicated them also need to be tried in the name of malicious prosecution.
In India, in case of Muslims in general and Kashmiris in particular, the law enforcing authorities have been given a license to harass, implicate and detain without any cause. That is why we find Muslim population in India is just 15%, whereas 35% prisoners of India are Muslims, and most of them are falsely implicated.
Sheikh added, Kashmir is an exceptional case where New Delhi has placed laws that allow authorities to detain people without any reason. Baba is happy to be back and is rejoicing the reunion with his family members. however, is in a constant dilemma where and how to start fresh. Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
For the first time in decades, Canada Day celebrations have been mostly muted as the country sees old wounds reopened. Various cities scrapped the celebrations following a series of horrific discoveries of unmarked graves around former Catholic schools for Indigenous children. Calls to scale back or cancel celebrations snowballed in May and June when almost 1,000 unmarked graves were found. Another discovery this week, comprising 182 graves of children aged 7 to 15, made matters even worse. The new findings have fueled outrage in the country over a lack of information and accountability regarding violations of Indigenous peoples' rights. The graves remind people of the horrors experienced by thousands of kids that were supposed to be assimilated into the white society in church-run boarding schools. Rallies have been held to honor over 4,000 victims of Canada's infamous residential schools, while Indigenous leaders have been calling for a thorough investigation. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has described the discoveries as a shameful reminder of systemic racism and urged the Catholic Church to take responsibility. The Roman Catholic Church is yet to issue a formal apology. Activists, however, believe the government is trying to put the onus on the Catholic Church and downplay its central role.
The Canadian government currently is trying to kind of put the onus more on the Catholic Church, on the churches, but obviously the Canadian government is central to this whole horrific history and ongoing colonization.
Indigenous children are not the only victims of racism in Canada. Reports say thousands of Indigenous women and girls have been murdered or gone missing in the country over the past 30 years. The National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls says a genocide is being perpetrated. But that's not all. A deadly attack on a Muslim family last month in Ontario and attacks on women wearing hijab in Alberta testify to the fact that racism has deep roots in the Canadian society. A new opinion poll shows some 36% of the Indigenous people and 42% of minorities believe Canada is a racist country. Canada, a country with a dark colonial history, has for decades depicted itself as an outspoken critic of racism and a leading advocate of human rights. But the latest discoveries of Indigenous graves and attacks against Muslims show Canada is yet to take meaningful measures to root out racism in its own society.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Closer, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company.
now in Mazandaran province, in the beautiful city of Behshahr. Today, we have an exciting travel. A travel in time. To how many years ago are we going to travel? 2,000 years ago? Oh no, 7,000 years ago? No. 10,000 years ago? No, higher than that. Let me tell you the story. We're going to travel to about 12,000 years ago. And maybe much more than that figure. Again, our travel is very exciting. We're going to travel to the ancient cave of Hotu. Hotu Cave is located in Terugen village in western Behshahr County. This village is known globally for its discovery of antiquities which belong to the primitive human beings. Hotu Cave is the oldest residence of the primitive human beings. Archaeologists have found the remains of human skull in Hotu Cave. By putting the remains of the skulls beside each other, the archaeologists have found that these skulls are different with the skulls of Neanderthals and mostly look like today's human skull. This is one of the most important discoveries of archaeologists, which is known as Hotu Man, and includes skeletons of a mature man and woman as well as the skeleton of a young woman. These discoveries were done in 1951 by a team led by Professor Carleton Stevens Kuhn from the University of Pennsylvania. The images of this discovery are available in the archive of the University of Pennsylvania Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology. I am now in Hotu Cave. The importance of the cave, as well as the value of the antiquities which have been found in this cave, are so high that researchers call this cave the gold mine of anthropologists. Visiting such a valuable and amazing historical site is really exciting, and honestly, I'm very excited. Oh, above my head, just in the middle of the Hotu cave, there is a big gap where I can see the blue sky. Dr. Hassan Fazeli, professor of archaeology from the University of Tehran, has interesting views about the Hotu cave. During the time you're listening to his statements, I try to imagine the way cavemen lived in this part of the cave.
This cave is one of the oldest ancient caves of Iran, which tells the story of humans' last years of life in cave, his exit from the cave, and the start of his residing in villages. This story is extremely valuable from the worldview. It seems that Mazandaran used to be one of the major economic hubs of the world history, and just like other regions of the Middle East, has been valuable from the point of view of understanding how agriculture started in the Middle East region.
خدمتنا
Once the entire city of Behshahr was beneath the Caspian Sea and the residents hunted seals residing near the cave. Gradually, with the water level falling, they started agriculture and animal husbandry.
Let me tell you something interesting. Dr. Fazeli, whose voice you just heard, has already led a team of Iranian archaeologists who have recently found the skeleton of a 6 to 8 month old baby in their excavations of the Hotu cave. This skeleton has been discovered in the layers of post-Paleolithic period of the cave. Another amazing thing is that this baby has been buried while seated. Around the baby's skull is decorated with red color by ochre, and that the baby has an interesting and bizarre necklace around the neck. The necklace has 3 wolf teeth among its beads. This necklace is among the first discoveries of such kind of ornaments in Iran, which has been made by hunter humans. Oh, I'm really excited and need some fresh air. I have to get out of the cave and take a walk. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Russia is accusing terrorist groups operating in Syria of getting ready to stage yet another false flag chemical attack. Moscow says the Jabhat al-Nusra terrorist group, along with members from other terrorist groups, are involved in this. Now, the chemicals, Moscow says, are being stockpiled in Idlib province in the northern de-escalation zone. The terrorists plan to use these chemicals against the people and then blame the Syrian government with the help of what Moscow calls a pseudo-humanitarian group, the White Helmets, who it says is an arm of the terrorists. Stay with us as we take a look at the latest that's taking place in Syria. Well, we're going to start it off by crossing over to Damascus and getting the latest from Mohammed Ali. Mohammed Ali, tell me what you have on this story, the latest information.
Yes, according to Deputy Chief of the Russian Center for Reconciliation based at Hmeymim Air Base in Syria, Vadim Kolet, he said that they received information that terrorists of the al-Nusra Front are planning for a provocation in the de-escalation zone of Idlib by carrying out a false flag chemical attack, and then they plan to accuse and blame the Syrian army for carrying out such a false flag chemical attack. Now, according to Colette, he said that terrorists of the al-Nusra Front, accompanied by members of the so-called White Helmets, transported 10 barrels of toxic substances to an area called Harem in Idlib over there in order to carry out this false flag chemical attack in the southern part of the Al-Zawiya mountain, also in the de-escalation zone of Idlib, and then accuse the Syrian army for such an attack. Of course, this is not the first time that Russia warns of such an attempt that terrorists are planning, of the Al-Nusra Front, of course, in Idlib. And according to many analysts, every time terrorists of the Al-Nusra Front feel or know that the Syrian army and its allies are preparing for an offensive to squash them in Idlib, they actually attempt to carry out such a false-side chemical attack because they want to invite some kind of foreign intervention or international pressure that would lead to perhaps stopping such a military operation. Finally, previously, we used to see in Syria exit deals in which terrorists get out via buses and then the government controls that area, terrorists go to Idlib. But now, terrorists have no other place to go after Idlib, so they know that they're going to be killed over there.
All right, thank you so much, Muhammad Ali, for giving us the update on the latest situation taking place there. I'm going to cross over now to Budapest. Welcome my next guest, George Zamudli, Senior Research Fellow, Global Policy Institute, and author of Bombs for Peace. Thank you so much for being with us. Are you surprised? I mean, we're seeing the same MO being replayed time and time again. Your assessment of this, are you surprised at this repeat of this scenario?
No, not surprised in the slightest. As you say, we had this same scenario in 2017 and in 2018, and the Trump administration took the bait and launched bombings attacks. We know for certain that both of them were absolutely fake. The Syrian government was not responsible for the chemical weapons attack, and there is no reason, there was never any reason anymore that there was a reason in 2013 in Ghouta for the Syrian government to use chemical weapons when essentially it has won the war. So therefore, the only purpose of creating these incidents is to justify a U.S. Military intervention, a U.S. attacks against the Syrian government. And I'm afraid that it's quite possible that this will happen. We've already seen that the Biden administration has twice bombed Syria. And I would fully expect them if such a situation occurred again, that the Biden administration would take the bait and bomb Syrian government positions.
Well, let me turn to London. Welcome my next guest to Spotlight, Dr. Marcus Papadopoulos, historian and analyst, author of the new book, Arise, Russia, The Return of Russia to World Politics. Thank you so much for being with us. Now, I want to look at Moscow has blamed the terrorist group's foreign handlers for these acts. Let's talk about, in your perspective, your analysis of all of this, the biggest supporters of the terror and instability still in Syria are which players?
Well, there's no question about it that the terrorists in Syria, specifically Al-Qaeda and ISIS, would not have been the potent force that they once were during the Syrian conflict without the assistance of major powers in the world. And those major powers are many, but in particular, they are as follows: America, Britain, France, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Israel. The terrorists, for a number of years during the Syrian conflict, advanced deeply into Syrian territory, conquering a number of Syrian cities, but in particular, conquering many Syrian towns, many Syrian villages. And the Syrian armed forces, which have been for decades now one of the best trained, one of the best equipped, and one of the best led in the Middle East, were faced with a deadly challenge from those terrorist groups. Therefore, it is simply inconceivable that those terrorist groups had been able to advance and deliver some very grievous blows to the Syrian army without the assistance of first-rate powers in the world. So, as I said moments ago, without the support of major powers in the world, and I would say most importantly of all, America and Britain, ISIS and Al-Qaeda would never have been the potent force that they once were in the Syrian conflict. And secondly, they never would have been able to inflict the grievous blows on the Syrian army that they once did. And they would never have been able to occupy the amount of Syrian territory that they once did.
Okay, well, George, now there was a chemical attack in Douma, Damascus suburb, and rebel-held area in 2018. United States and the United Kingdom blamed the Syrian government for the attack and initiated airstrikes against government targets. Now, the Organization of Prohibited Chemical Weapons investigated, and as you know, there was much controversy internally with disagreements with the inspectors and even reports of cover-up. I want to talk about the importance of all this, the role the OPCW is playing actually in perhaps helping the terrorists, because we saw even some of the inspectors trying to come out and say they disagreed with the report, but basically they were shut down.
Yes, you've summarized it perfectly. That's exactly what happened. The actual inspectors who went to Douma did not find any evidence of the use of chemical weapons, and they wrote that in their report. But of course, this was not acceptable to the bureaucracy of OPCW that relies on the United States and the United Kingdom and the rest of them. And so they rewrote the report, but essentially completely falsifying the findings of the actual inspectors, the actual experts. So that's why there is no way that, if there is a chemical weapons attack, and the OPCW again sends in their inspectors, there's absolutely no reason why we should believe in any way anything that the OPCW finds. And you're absolutely right. They do serve as the enablers of the terrorists because they're there then to scream, oh, yeah, yeah, Syria used these terrible chemical weapons, and therefore then the United States and the United Kingdom can then triumphantly say, well, we have no choice but to act. So I think this is it's a great danger. But there is also a drumbeat that's going on right now. As you probably know, there was a debate at the United Nations Security Council about opening up additional border crossings to get, quote, humanitarian aid, unquote, into Idlib. So you can see that there is a kind of Western propaganda drumbeat taking place right now of Idlib, and that's why I think this is a very dangerous situation.
Well, Marcus, what about that? I mean, George just talked about this, the discussion in the United Nations about opening, as he said, so-called humanitarian corridor. Now, I want to talk about the role of these so-called international organizations and what has been happening in Syria. I mean, it seems as if what they have been doing is basically in support of these neoliberal regimes instead of being actually a player to try to control the situation and de-escalate. Your take.
Well, whilst the creation of the United Nations was an honorable and admirable one, the problem is not the United Nations per se. The problem lies with certain members of the United Nations who abuse bodies of the United Nations and mechanisms of the United Nations. And again, the two principal offenders are America and Britain. Washington and London use their immense global clout, both political, economic, military, and cultural clout, to penetrate bodies of the United Nations in order to use them as tools of Western foreign policy objectives. So I do not believe that there is a problem per se with the United Nations. The problem, as I said moments ago, lies with certain powerful countries in the world who abuse their membership of the UN to pursue their foreign policy objectives. And in the case of Syria, we see how Washington and London have unashamedly used the United Nations to provide cover for the terrorists in Syria, both Al-Qaeda and ISIS. The way in which the Americans and the British have used the United Nations to portray the so-called freedom fighters in Syria is really quite sickening, and it goes to show once again how the old maxim is correct: might is right. Because the Americans and the British know very well whom they are supporting in Syria. They know that the groups they are supporting are Wahhabist groups, who are essentially ideologically the same people who carried out the terrorist attacks in New York and Washington in 2001 and in London in 2005 and in 2017 and in Bali and so on and so on.
Okay.
But of course, those terrorist groups are potent weapons of the Americans and the British, and they have used them in many conflicts, not just the Syrian one, but the Bosnian one too.
George, your take on what Marcus has said, and if you agree with what he's saying, I mean, what exactly does that mean? The same terrorist that has caused havoc in various Western cities is the same group that then these same capitals, London and Washington, are actually supporting in Syria. So what is it that the United States and the United Kingdom, what's the goal? What are they really after?
Well, the goal is regime change. These terrorists, whether it's ISIS or Al-Qaeda, are very useful to effect regime change. I mean, either they can wage a war ad infinitum, they can just debilitate a country and drain them, as it looked like it would happen in Syria before Russia made its very significant intervention in the fall of 2015, which arrested the progress of the these jihadi terrorists. So either that or via these staged incidents and therefore, you know, which again then justify Western intervention. But of course, the longer these wars continue, then the longer or the greater the imperative within the Western capitals to continually apply further and further pressure against, for example, in this case, the Syrian government via sanctions. Because, of course, the Syrian government gets blamed for the war, gets blamed for the atrocities, gets blamed for everything that's gone wrong in Syria, and so therefore that serves to justify the horrific sanctions regime imposed by the United States and the European Union. And Marcus is absolutely right. There's no secret that the United States used ISIS in Syria and in Iraq. And we have John Kerry's confession on this score. We have Joe Biden's confession on this score. They're open about it. They used ISIS in order to topple Bashar al-Assad. They failed. They also used ISIS to effect a regime change in Iraq, because the person was then prime minister. The Americans didn't care for him. So that's what happened. And Marcus is right. This was what they did, this same thing in Bosnia, mm-hmm. and which then served. You know, again, there were all these sudden atrocities, which always happened in the same place. And particularly at crucial moments in the war,
okay.
and then which takes of the justification for NATO military intervention.
Well, Marcus, now, Russia's previously talked about the role of the white helmets, this so-called, as they're talking about, presenting themselves as a humanitarian group, but Russia's talked about them serving, actually, the terrorist cells in Syria. I want to talk about the role of the white helmets in this, and how they're getting away with really not even being condemned, not even being examined by the so-called mainstream media. Your take on this?
British state propaganda is formidable, and in my opinion, it is the foremost propaganda outlet in the world, and I would also say in recent times. And the White Helmets is just one example of that. The White Helmets, far from being a humanitarian organization, is nothing more than a propaganda outfit created and financed by the British state, not Britain, by the British state. The two are very different entities. Created and financed by the British state to depict the Syrian government in the most awful of manners, as a justification for supporting the so-called freedom fighters in Syria, and as a justification for the economic sanctions imposed by America and the European Union on the Syrian government. Now, the White Helmets, the creation of the White Helmets, has been exceedingly successful in that it has convinced a great many people, in particular in the Western world, that this organization is a humanitarian one. However, it is quite easy to punch holes and large holes in the image which is projected by London of the White Helmets. So, for instance, why is it that the White Helmets, who purport to be a humanitarian organization serving the Syrian people, only operate in territories controlled by either ISIS or Al-Qaeda? If they were an organization serving humanitarian purposes in Syria, then they would be all over Syria. They would be in parts controlled by the Syrian government and in parts controlled by ISIS or Al-Qaeda. But they never have been in areas controlled by the Syrian government. So it is a very simple situation in which we find that the White Helmet is but a tool of the British state to further the objective of London and Washington in Syria, namely the overthrow of the Syrian government, the destruction of the Syrian state, the creation of a new Syrian state, which would be subservient to the West and compliant with Israel.
All right. Well, George, really quickly, 30 seconds. Where do you see this going? What is it going to take to actually bring peace to Syria again? And these Western regimes should accept their losses. We've just seen the Syrian people vote in a presidential election. What is it going to take to end the chaos there?
Well, you may not like the answer. My own feeling is that the only way that you can bring about peace in Syria is if the Syrian government, with the assistance of the Russians, makes the final move for Idlib and bring Idlib under Syrian government control and finally rid the country of this Al-Qaeda.
Now, okay, and on that note, I have to thank you both. So sorry, we're out of time. I appreciate you being with us. Dr. Marcus Papadopoulos, historian and analyst, author of the new book, Arise, Russia, The Rise of Russia to World Politics, out of London, and George Samutli, senior research fellow, Global Policy Institute, author, Bombs for Peace, out of Budapest. Thank you so much for joining me right here on Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.